Miami was once dubbed the Gateway of the Americas. It's much more than that, according to a new report. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. That report comes from the Miami Urban Future Initiative, and it puts Miami into the category of global city. Actually, it has Miami competing with New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco as a globalized metropolis. We'll find out what's turned our region, South Florida, into a new powerhouse. Plus, horror movie lovers rejoice. The annual Popcorn Frights Film Festival is back, and we're going to talk about the locally grown horror writers and filmmakers and what scares we can expect this year. And food lovers rejoice. Miami Spice is back. Norman Van Aken will talk to us about why this event has been so successful all these years, but we'll also talk about the challenges restaurants face in trying to produce more menus from locally grown foods. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we know South Florida is an international region with deep ties to Latin America, but is it among the most globally connected areas in America? A recent report from the Miami Urban Future Initiative presents the case that the Miami metro area competes with New York, San Francisco, and LA to be a top globalized city. The study looks at a cross-section of data from the numbers of immigrants owning businesses to international flights to exports to determine what makes us such an internationally connected place. The Miami Urban Future Initiative is a partnership with FIU, the Knight Foundation, and the Creative Class Group. Stephen Pedigo is the co-author of the study and is an economic advisor for the Creative Class Group. He's also the director of the NYU Shack Institute Urban Lab, and he's joining us via Skype to break down the findings of this report. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us, man. I appreciate it.
Louis, thanks for having me.
You know, is it fair to say that Miami is one of America's most globally connected cities?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about our study was that we sought out to ask that answer that specific question. And I think when you start to look at an array of different types of metrics, you know, the types of people that make up Miami, the connections that Miami has to the world, the types of business that's done in Miami, what you start to see is some amazing connections to other international communities, actually.
Yeah, let's talk about how you measure these global connections and what raises Miami up. What are a couple of the big ones? You kind of just touched on it.
Yeah, so the things that we looked at specifically, right? One is the people that live in Miami. I think if you look at Miami's makeup of its community, what you find is that it has a large number of immigrants that are living there, foreign-born residents. And in fact, it ranks first among all of the 52 largest metropolitan areas in the country. But more importantly than that, not just international residents, we looked at international residents who have advanced degrees and bachelor's degrees, right? That is that sort of educated, what we would call that quote-unquote creative class. And what was very interesting is that Miami actually ranked second, only behind San Jose. So it's interesting that when you look at Miami's population, it's very international, but it's very internationally and educated as well. So that was one key indicator that we looked at. You know, the other thing that we looked at was this idea of exports and imports. And with the whole debate around tariffs and things now, we're hearing more about this conversation about how many goods and services are exported out of a region. And what's interesting is that when we looked at exports, Miami is among the top 10 in terms of exports. So this question of connections of the types of business that is happening in the community is absolutely globally connected. The third thing that we looked at, which is absolutely a strength for Miami, is this idea of a global airport. And in fact, if you do the type of work that I do, which is sort of helping and advising cities think about their economic development strategies, airports play an amazing important role. In fact, we would argue that outside of universities, they tend to be one of the most important assets that a community can have and invest in. And as we looked at Miami's airport, Miami's airport is number one for international freight, almost 1.5 million tons. We look at the types of airport passengers, almost 26.6 million airport passengers, ranking second in the country. So this idea of that not only are you a cosmopolitan international region with educated talent that is doing international business, but you're globally connected as well. The final thing that we looked at is we looked at international businesses. Miami ranks among the top 10 for foreign-owned businesses as well. Those are the types of businesses that are owned by immigrants throughout the country.
Let me tackle a couple of these. So there's a lot going on there. Let's come back to the immigrant population. So second only to San Jose in the percentage of the immigrants living in within the area. Do we know how many of those folks are coming in with higher degrees, with a lot of education?
Yeah, almost 40% of the population of those residents have some type of bachelor's degree and associate's degree. So it is a large number of residents that are international residents who are living in Miami who are educated. So it's absolutely an asset for Miami in terms of the educational attainment of those residents.
And why are they coming to Miami? Is there something specific about this region, or is it just, well, geographically, maybe it's just closer than other places? I mean, what's special about this place?
I think there are lots of things for Miami, right? Obviously, the geographical location plays an important role, particularly as you look at Latin America and the Caribbean. So absolutely, to your point, that proximity plays an important piece. But, you know, I think the other thing for a lot of international communities is that the folks are attracted to the quality of place. A lot of the assets that Miami has to offer, you know, great things in terms of some sense of affordability. You know, there's obviously great restaurants. There's great lifestyle to be had in Miami, which we know that a lot of educated creative class workers today, as they make those location decisions, are absolutely attracted to those issues of quality of place. So those, you know, if we're thinking about those two assets, those play an important role, not to mention that Miami's got some very interesting emerging industries that are attracting both international investment as well as people. You're develop it as a international media center, looking at healthcare and biosciences, looking at the role of your large growing sort of startup community that's doing a lot around consumer goods. A lot of those industries are also helping to attract both foreign investment as well as foreign workers.
And you talked about this city being a major location for exporting. What are we exporting most?
Well, you are absolutely, if we're looking at financial services, is a very important service that's getting exported, business services. There's also a lot of physical cargo that comes through Miami as well. So it is both on the physical goods sides of things, but also a lot of the services that Miami's industries provide as well.
And then you talk about the airport, and I guess maybe we take for granted that we have such a big airport that's actually expanded over the last decade. But and it's not just the fact that we're bringing in tourists. It's also, as you said, we're bringing in a lot of freight. We're bringing in people from not just Latin America, but around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you think about Miami's assets and what you can really build upon from an economic development standpoint, the airport is critical. Yes, it's important to the tourism sector in Miami, which is a very large key piece of the economy, but it's also important for business, right? One of the things that we have found through some additional research, not this study, but others, is looking at the idea of the importance of an airport. And yes, it's important to move people for hospitality and move physical goods, but the fact that you can connect people throughout the world in terms of business hubs is really critical. So you can imagine that as Miami continues to invest in its assets, particularly this idea, is it a financial center or is it a business center or a place that's doing all of those interesting sectors of research or investment? The airport will play a very, very important role in terms of being able to connect people to hub to hub.
I'm talking with Stephen Pettigope, director of the NYU Shack Institute Urban Lab and economic advisor for the Creative Class Group. He's the co-author of a new study entitled Benchmarking Miami's Globalization. We're examining the factors that make Miami one of the most internationally connected cities in the country right now, even beyond New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco. Stephen, you had mentioned earlier, too, when you talk about immigrants coming to the area, being attracted to the area, and not just bringing, their degrees, higher education, but also we're talking about a creative class that's coming in and developing here. First, let's start by defining what is the creative class.
Sure. We define the creative class as people that have skills in technology, research and design, folks that have skills in arts and culture, professional services, as well as sort of that research piece. People like myself who work at universities, for instance.
And so, I mean, is it that we're attracting those people here, or are we developing? Are we doing a good job of developing that here within our own population?
I think you're doing both pretty well. Let me give you an example. So, for instance, one of the things that we know is that Miami's, if we look at the share, the larger share of Miami's creative class over the last decade, that number itself has grown, not just for international residents, but also domestic residents as well. So there is a large rising tide in Miami's creative class, partly because it's becoming an even more appealing place to live. It's competing with the likes of New York and Washington, D.C. and San Francisco and Chicago and others. So it's becoming a center that is, in a sense, almost becoming a magnet for talent. The other thing that I would say that Miami has done very well, and this is a credit to the higher education institutions there, for instance, our partner, FIU University, has done a very good job of being a gateway institution, an institution that's providing opportunity for students to connect into the local industries there. If you look at, for instance, some of the interesting emerging sectors around technology or computer science or health services, FIU and others like Miami University have done a very good job of building those sort of industry partnerships that really provide that pathway. You know, and that's really critical. One of the things that we tell universities and tell communities all over the world is that that pathway, creating that stickiness for university students, is really important. You know, Miami is one of the top 10 largest college towns in the country if we look at the sheer number of students. And so being able to not only keep those college students there, but also mix that with some of the international talent that you have. You know, Miami's sort of seeing this real rebirth of its knowledge and creative-based sectors for sure.
And then we've talked about this on the program many times, actually, that this is now the hottest place for startup, for the startup culture, for the growth of entrepreneurship. South Florida, again, recently ranked as the top region in the country for new business. But how does the startup culture here and investment in new businesses contribute to, you know, everything that you found?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting is that when we looked at foreign-born businesses, right, those are businesses or startup businesses that are owned by international immigrants, it is interesting. Miami's among the top 10 there. But what we found was a lot of those small businesses tend to be smaller in scale comparatively to, so for instance, like San Jose or San Francisco or even New York. So one of the things I think is we look at Miami's startup culture, which if we think about the improvements that have happened to support that the growth of a technology-based sector, a startup sector in Miami over the last decade, it's been amazing, partly in effort because of a lot of the efforts of the regional economic development groups, but also folks like the Knight Foundation and others. You know, there is an opportunity here to grow this even more. And that is to say, while we're seeing lots of startup activity, and you're right, ranked first on the index for this, one of the things that we want to make sure we're doing is growing and scaling those businesses, moving those businesses just beyond local service to this idea of, again, how do they export goods and services outside of the region to other places of the country, other places of the world. So in my mind, there's a lot of growth opportunity for Miami in terms of this question of how do you help grow and scale some of the international businesses that are there.
All right. So we're painting this really pretty picture of Miami and the South Florida region, but let me flip it a little bit on you here. So we depend a lot on real estate and as you said, the finance sector. How might those be a negative factor, though?
Well, I think, you know, there is lots of concern. I mean, that's, I think what you're asking is some of the concerns that we have as we think about Miami's, one of the Miami's economy, but also some of the challenges. I think that if I was looking at Miami's sector, one of the things that I would suggest is that you're right. There is a heavy presence on real estate, even hospitality development. So this question about how do we grow other sectors in the economy, right, that can play a larger role. So, for instance, when there is a downturn in the economy, we don't feel the crash as heavy in the community. So in my mind, that goes to really gearing up support for, you know, biosciences, health sciences, where we know there's this real specialization and real sort of expertise in the region that's growing. It's about growing the media and broadcast center there, right, in terms of thinking about Miami as a place that's pushing out new ideas and information. So there's other sectors that will need support. That said, there are issues that we have to address with some of the livability. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, you know, I think one of the things that's exciting about Miami is that, yes, it's got great quality of places, attracting talent all over the world. What we know, though, is that we do face challenges of affordability, transportation, all of those challenges that a lot of growing metropolitan areas face. And we're going to have to address those issues head on Because when a region gets between 5 and 6 million people, as you know, it becomes congested. It starts filling that start in traffic without having that connectivity.
We just did a show yesterday on public transit. So, yes, we do know that. we're talking about the immigrant population, too, is and another question about, volatility is the fact that we have a number of immigrants from Latin American countries under extreme political turmoil. I think of Venezuela, Nicaragua. Do the economic and political instabilities of these countries threaten Miami's economic standing and our position globally, I guess?
I think I would flip it. I would ask this question: does some of the policies that the United States is looking at in terms of how it's managing its immigration have an impact on Miami? And one of the things that we believe, my colleagues, Rich Florida and others at the initiative, is that, look, as we look at the national immigration policies, Miami, like, regions like San Francisco, San Jose, New York, et cetera, may feel the pressures of some federal immigration policies in other metropolitan areas. So in my mind, it's more this question, not of what other countries are doing, but what is the feel that we're sort of seeing here domestically in our sort of federal policies and immigration that will impact some of our cities.
Let me finish with this. It's my understanding you're planning to follow up on this study this year. What's going to be different?
We are. So we're going to continue to track the progress of this. The idea of Miami as a global city will continue to be a key piece of this. I think one of the things that we'll dive a little bit deeper in is to look at how are particular growth sectors impacted by Miami's sort of role as a global center. I think we'll be interested to look greater at not just the connections that Miami have between Latin America and the Caribbean, but also these connections to Europe, I think is a question that we're really centered on. So that's part of the global city work. We're also going to do some new analysis. We're going to look at affordability this year. We're going to dive deeply into affordability. We're going to dive deeply into this question of transit and connectivity. So there are some new ideas and new reports that we're also going to issue on the upcoming year. Just to continue this conversation, I think one of the things that we're excited about at the Miami Urban Future Initiative is helping to provide policy leaders, elected officials, with the expertise and with the knowledge to help inform some policy decisions, as well as just some investment and recruitment opportunities as well.
Stephen Pettigo, again, director of the NYU Shack Institute Urban Lab and economic advisor for the Creative Class Group. He's one of the co-authors of the new study entitled Benchmarking Miami's Globalization. Again, looking at how Miami has become one of the more internationally connected cities here in the United States. Stephen, it's always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And again, Stephen was joining us via Skype. Well, still to come, for lovers of horror in South Florida, your event has arrived. We'll tell you all about the Popcorn Frights Film Festival kicking off this Friday. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, it's back. The annual Popcorn Frights Film Festival has returned, but this year it's in Fort Lauderdale. It's a collection of full-length feature films and shorts, international and locally produced horror thrillers. And this year, there's even going to be dancing zombies. Yes, you heard me right. Dancing zombies. I love it already. One of the films featured this year is The Horse and the Stag. That's a locally produced short by local Jonathan Cuartas. It's a chilling film with a subtext of bullying about a young man named Carson. And he's abducted by a woman, Edith, and is held captive in her home. Now, here's a clip from the short where Carson is pleading with his captor.
I don't know what's in there that's making you do this to me. But I'm a good person. Do you hear me? I'm a good person.
Well, joining us now is the writer and director of that film, Jonathan Cuartas. Jonathan, such a pleasure, man. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And the festival's co-founder and co-director, Igor Sterenberg. Igor, it's always a pleasure, man. Thank you.
Always a thrill.
Thank you so much. Igor, how do you describe this experience, the festival, to anyone who has not yet experienced Popcorn Frights?
It's the most fun you'll ever have being scared. I mean, truly, if you have a taste for terror, you have a date with Popcorn Frights.
But that's a good point, though. Do you have to have a taste for terror? Do you have to be a horror nerd?
No, you just have to be willing to be open for discovery. These are films from 15 different countries. We really did a global search for the very best that genre cinema has to offer. And they all work in an incredibly brilliant artistic merit. there's not a film in our lineup that isn't going to shock and awe you and also have some sort of intellectual, you know, gratification. There's not just gore in many of these films. There's layered subtext that you will be appreciating.
And I did mention earlier, we are going to be talking about Singing Zombies. But why is it in Fort Lauderdale this year?
It's a bigger venue. But more importantly, many of you may not know, but Savor Cinema in the 1940s was a Methodist church. And to be able to raise Holy Hell in a former Methodist church was an opportunity we just couldn't pass. But more seriously, it just afforded us a bigger platform. You know, we had to turn away so many film lovers the last 3 years because we'd sell out in advance of the festival, and it just kind of really hurt our hearts. So we just knew that we needed to expand our footprint, and Savor affords us a much larger space, 240 seats.
Okay, so yeah, no, I was going to say that. How much bigger is it from before? So it's I mean, you've expanded
more than twice the size. Yeah.
What was one of the highlights from last year?
Joe Lynch, the movie Mayhem, and we just completely rocked all of Wynwood with him. And the movie went on after winning our audience award to set a new record for a horror film for being streamed online. It really took over the entire horror world by storm.
So we're looking forward to some new highlights for this year. All right, so Jonathan, let me come back to you because you are one of the local filmmakers.
Yes.
And this is one of the interesting things too, Igor, is the fact that it's not just about bringing in big names and movies from around the world, but it's about putting a focus on local.
That's right. Building on last year, we launched this sidebar called Homegrown 100% Pure Fresh Squeezed Florida Horror. And we realized that there is an incredible genre scene here in Miami with aspiring filmmakers that we needed to tap into. We needed to give them a platform to showcase their work. And it was to our surprise just how many of them were there and how great their films were. And we're so thrilled to just continue this particular sidebar and have Jonathan be a part of it.
Jonathan, you're from here.
Yes, born and raised.
Born and raised. You know what? You have one of the shorts this year, and we played a little piece of it earlier. But tell us a little bit about, I mean, how do you describe to folks The Horse and the Stag?
So as you said, the premise is it involves a young man's paranoia as he's held captive in a grieving mother's motorhome. So I kind of went with the subtext of bullying, and I wanted to play with emotion and empathy, which I like doing with horror. I like having a drama, a story that is essentially a drama, and wrapping it in the tropes of a horror film. And I wanted to explore bullying and see it from the eyes of the perpetrator and then flip the empathy.
Why is that issue important to you?
Well, I was bullied as a kid, and I see a lot of I know the suicide rates are high with bullying, and I just think it's important to talk about it and be completely unflinching in the portrayal of the stuff that comes out that has to do with bullying and show it as heavy as you can.
There, I wanted to play another clip. This one is, here's the scene again. This film is these two characters, Carson and Edith. Edith, again, his captor. And this is a scene where Carson, again, is confronting Edith. Edith actually now is really... this is her response.
Nobody likes you. You think you're so smart. But none of our teachers like you. I bet your mother wishes she never had you.
I don't have a mother.
I bet they wish you were dead. I wish you were dead.
This is one of those, and I look, I'd be the first to say that, you know, I have told Igor this before too, is I'm a child of the 70s and 80s. Mm. So I remember a lot of my horror diet was the campy, you know, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street type of stuff. This is, you know, even for a short, I mean, this is really an uncomfortable thriller. It's claustrophobic, takes place in this one little space. And it's really dark, and I'm talking about the lighting in of itself. It's very dark. But I wanted to get a sense of what, you know, where you're coming from when you were putting this together. This was, by the way, filmed in Homestead.
Yes.
All of it.
Yes, all of it. Well, actually, the diner scene, a brief diner scene, was filmed in Miami Gardens, rest was Homestead.
Why, by the way, why'd you pick that place? Why there?
Because Well, first of all, we found the location. It was on my friend. He's a fellow filmmaker as well. And it was on his property, an abandoned motorhome that was left there after Hurricane Irma. The owners had to move out because you just couldn't live there anymore. And the way it looks, if you think that looks bad, you should have seen it before we dressed it. It was leaking water. I could barely fit in there. It's just as claustrophobic filming it as it feels in the film.
Tell me a little bit about your process in writing when you're writing something like this. I mean, are you thinking in terms of camera angles, camera shots, or are you writing a story first?
I think it's story first, and I think that Miami and Homestead and all the neighborhoods around South Florida, they provide such a distinct canvas for these stories that I feel like the story almost writes itself. I start with something that relates to me personally. In this case, it was bullying, and then I wrap it in this claustrophobic motorhome, and I feel like the situation just builds itself.
What does a festival like the Popcorn Frights do for filmmakers like you? How does it help you? Because you, I mean, look, you've also had films in many other festivals as well.
Sure.
But locally, what does this, like, one like this do?
Well, I think that genre film is very important here in South Florida, and I think it's underlooked. So having a festival like Popcorn Frights that celebrates genre, I think it's extremely important because it's nice to have genre films in Miami. You see a lot of films that it kind of caters to the location and geography of Miami, Miami Beach. There's certain stories that are told here, which are great, but I feel like having a festival that embraces genre is really fun and really important.
You told me that, you know, you've sent out your stuff, your work to so many different festivals. Yeah. And, you know, you get a lot of rejections.
Yep.
What, I mean, how hard is it to get into festivals?
It's hard. And when you, as you progress making more and more films, you try to submit to higher tier festivals. So the rejections come in.
Igor, how many different films, filmmakers are sending you their stuff and like, hey, we want to be in your festival?
We had a record number of submissions this year. It nearly exceeded 1,000. And that's not counting films that we just saw ourselves at various festivals and solicited on our own. There's more and more films being made, and there's less and less channels for them to be seen and experienced. So to be able to have a platform that we host on our own, this is not my full-time job. I literally volunteer my hours to do this.
You also run the Jewish Film Festival as well. So you
absolutely. And to be able to showcase what I think are the very best international films from around the world with a focus on genre is rewarding. It's incredibly rewarding and enriching.
How do you do it? How do you, you know, is it a panel of people? How do you go through that 1,000 entries to pick those few dozen that you're going to be?
We have a committed group of volunteers that we call the Midnight Society. To those of you who grew up with Nickelodeon and Are You Afraid of the Dark? You're familiar with that. We all look at the films. We all relate to them. We have vicious arguments about which films we really love more than others. And it's the films that have the biggest staying power, that gnaw at us the most, that we are obsessed over and keep on going over and over again weeks and months after, are the ones we feel are most committed to showing at our festival. Ultimately, we only have so many slots. We can only show so many titles. We run only for a week, and we have only one venue. So there's the definite limitations of what we can achieve.
We're talking about the 2018 Popcorn Frights Film Festival. This year it's in Fort Lauderdale. There are dozens of movies on the lineup. We're talking with the co-founder and co-director Igor Sterenberg and writer-director of one of those films in this year's festival, Jonathan Cuartas. The festival, again, starts on Friday. We have more information up on our Facebook page. Just look us up on social media, WLRN Sundial. Jonathan, you said something interesting earlier. You talk about location, finding the right locales and where people want to go and film. But what is it specifically about Miami that, you know, South Florida, that lends itself, that gives itself, you know, the opportunity to be a great place to tell stories?
Well, first of all, the people and the geography is, I think you can't get more diverse. And I talked to one of my good friends about this, and he's also a filmmaker and a festival programmer, and he said that the fish to pond ratio is very important. So
fish to pond ratio.
Yes.
Okay.
So you could go to LA, which is the film mecca essentially, but if you make a short film over there, everyone else is making short films too. If you make a short film here, more of a chance that you stand out, especially if you make a genre short film.
So Miami's a good place to get started then.
Yeah. I started here. I went to school here for film. I met so many wonderful people, and we're all friends and filmmakers.
And this question's for both of you. Jonathan, let me start with you, but I wanted to get a sense of, you know, do we have the infrastructure here, you know, to build that homegrown talent? Do we have the, you know, the universities have the programs? Do we have the talent already? I'm not talking about actors, because you can find actors everywhere. Yeah. I'm talking about, you know, do you have those skill sets, the skilled workers that are behind the scenes? Is everything here to start, really start building up our own film industry?
100%. As working on 4 short films, the crews that I've been able to work with, I've been blessed to have them and to work with them. And I've worked on other films, on other positions, production assistant, camera, whatever the case may be. The people here are always nice, and they're always very experienced.
And Igor, yeah, I mean, he's talking about that fish to pond ratio. I haven't heard that before, but I mean, is this the place people think start a career here again instead of going to LA or something like that?
We've continued to be surprised by the quality of work being made here in Miami, and it's so distinct. It has such a different flavor than all the other films that we receive viewings of from around the world. I absolutely feel that Miami is going through an incredible, very flourishing production scene. And my hopes are it just will continue to take off. When we talk about short films, hopefully in a year or two or three, we're going to be talking about feature-length films.
You know what? There was a great little video, by the way, that I found online, Jonathan, of you and your brother. And yes. It was, I guess you guys were raising money for your project.
Yep.
So this is, I mean, I guess this is the way that it works now, is you're pitching yourself out there to the world, to people. Traditionally, where do you go to try to get money for your project?
Well, since I've worked with moderately low budgets for shorts, I usually self-fund it. I pay it out of my own pocket, or my brother he's a co-producer cinematographer, and we always share the expenses. But for this, we wanted to do something a little more ambitious, so we went to a crowdfunding platform called Indiegogo, where we reached out to film communities, our families, our friends, and that's how we raised the funds for this.
So then, yeah, the investors, they buy the rights to this? Is this an investment? They're getting money back later? Or is it just that they see a young guy like you and they're like, maybe this is the future. We're going to try to help build him up.
So, yeah, we did the video that you saw was just a pitch video. So in that particular website, that platform, you offer perks. So let's say someone gives $5, you give them something in return.
All right, tell them about what are the perks, by the way, because I watched the video,
yeah.
And one of the perks you offer is something your dad does.
Yes, art.
Your dad's an artist, and he's going to offer a certain number of paintings.
Yes.
Okay. Whatever it takes, right? That's how we get
art
going.
Art for art, right?
There you go. Igor, you know what? I wondered, too, when you talk about money, the money in the business and the investors, do they see Miami as this is a place we need to plant ourselves for future talent, or are we not there yet?
5 years ago, they didn't. 3 years ago, we were just partially on the radar. Today, they look at Miami as a new vehicle to promote their genre films. We get contacted by major studios constantly with regards to opportunities to host their events and promote them, and even to consider their movies for our festival. We are hopeful that this is just the beginning of a long and exciting process, that Miami is going to be on the genre map just like Austin and Toronto and Montreal and LA are.
All right, let's get back to horror. And let's talk about this festival real quickly. You said you've got a couple dozen different movies that you're going to be featuring. Two dozen. And they're all in the same venue.
Right.
So tell me about a couple of them that you really are excited about. I mean, I know you're excited about all of them. You're like a dad. You love them all.
Right. Anne and the Apocalypse is a film that really is a home run. For those that love musicals and even TV comedies like Glee, and those that grew up with Shaun of the Dead, this is the perfect coupling that you can't miss. And accompanying this feature premiere, we're going to have a live musical performance from Infinite Abyss Productions. They're a local theater troupe. They're going to be dressed as zombies singing and dancing. And we're also going to have, on top of all of that, the director John McPhail, all the way from United Kingdom, flying down here to host the premiere. How could you miss that?
Anna and the Apocalypse.
How can you miss that?
Singing and zombies. I'm in, dude.
And we're going to have a triple bill of fear on our opening night. And closing the night, we're going to have Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, which is possibly the wildest genre film that you'll see this year, maybe in the decade. And remarkably, and beyond even our wildest dreams, we are going to have the composer Fabio Parisi in attendance. Fabio is a legendary composer. If you grew up with genre film from the 70s and 80s, he composed many of those beloved horror films. And it was a shock to us to know that he was going to be in town for the festival. How could he miss that?
Part of my childhood.
That's right. And then we have an Indonesian film, believe it or not, an Indonesian film called Satan's Slaves. And it's the creepiest, spookiest, eeriest, most chillingest film that's going to get under your skin and really make you stay up all night for all the bumps that you're going to hear. It is absolutely ferocious, and you have to see it to believe it. Another film is, I can't believe we even had the great privilege to announce this, but we have Blumhouse's New Nightmare. Blumhouse, the production studio behind Get Out, then the new Glass film, and Split, and we have the new film called Boogeyman Pop. It's a fever dream of a film that I encourage everyone to give a chance to take a look at before it becomes a big mainstream success like most of Blumhouse's movies.
And this the festival begins on Friday with three movies, and it runs through
August 16th.
All right, and again, tell everybody where it's at.
Saber Cinema,
which I love the fact, as you said, it used to be a church.
Right.
You're enjoying this way too much, is what I'm saying.
We have to. We do it all for the love of horror.
Again, it is the 2018 Popcorn Frights Film Festival. As he said, it's in Fort Lauderdale. Starts on Friday, and it's an amazing lineup. He gave us a little piece of that. Again, he is the co-founder, co-director, Igor Sterenberg. We also heard from writer-director of one of the films in the festival this year, Jonathan Cuartas. He is a local. It is a locally grown, local film. And an interesting, fascinating, by the way, short, as we pointed out, as I played a couple of pieces from it. We watched it this morning, and this is a great way to start
the day. Thank you.
As always, this is just so much fun. Igor, a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Have a scary, scary time, Jonathan. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Pleasant dreams.
Lots of pleasant dreams, definitely. All right, still to come, Imy Spice has returned. What restaurants are on your list for this year's event? That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. So Miami Spice is a unique opportunity for South Floridians to try some of Miami's best restaurants at an affordable price. Now in its 17th year, Miami Spice kicked off August 1st. It runs to the end of September. The idea is simple. The 244 participating restaurants will offer a three-course prefixed lunch menu at $23 and a three-course prefixed dinner for $39. And this year, the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau has teamed up with the nonprofit Slow Food Miami to dedicate certain restaurants with a snail of approval. This means the restaurants are deemed to have meals with ingredients that are locally sourced, sustainably grown, and of high quality. Well, here to discuss this year's Miami Spice and the local food movement in Miami, our own Chef Norman Van Aken. You hear him all the time of Edible South Florida. You hear him all the time here on WLRN. Norman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Louis.
Also joining us from Edible South Florida editor Gretchen Schmidt. Gretchen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. And just to mention again, as I said, Norman, you can hear him every weekend here on WLRN, A Word on Food. But he's also well known across South Florida for his restaurants. And he recently opened three kitchens in Wynwood. So as always, a pleasure to have you here. Let's start with this. Miami Spice brings more business into restaurants when it's traditionally a slow time of year. And it exposes restaurant goers to places they probably wouldn't usually go to, whether it's because of cost, distance, or convenience. Norman, in the years that you've taken part in Miami Spice, how much of an uptick do we tend to see because of it? What does it really do?
Well, it's dramatic, Louis. I began cooking in South Florida all the way down in Key West, where summer was like incredibly slow.
Why is summer slow? Again, it's South Florida.
It's so hot. You know, if you have money, you're going to go somewhere north, I guess. Isn't that real? And so it's everything is seasonal in life. And so I'm glad the Convention Bureau came up with this idea. My first blush with it, I was a little bit dubious. I was wondering what it was going to mean. We were, when we started with Norman's in 1995, we're a little bit more high-end restaurant. I thought, this might not be kind of the thing for us. But I was delighted to see how much it made a difference to not only us that own the restaurant, but also the people who work on the service side.
And who do you tend to see? Is it the regulars, or do you get new faces, tourists? Who does this attract?
You know, over the years, I think it really has become the locals who are our regulars many times, too. And they enjoy seeing what we're going to do because it's a different expression of the menu. There's some new things that are coming to the menu because of it. It's a great time of the year from standpoint of the growing, you know, for South Florida. So we're able to utilize a lot of things that that weren't there yesterday. And so the local farmers come out and bring us different things this time of year, too.
Gretchen, what is it? What's unique about Miami Spice? And if anything, how much has it changed over the years? 17 years now.
That's right. It seems now that some of the restaurants, especially this year, because I go into all the menus and see what they're cooking, and they are using more local ingredients, I think. They're using a lot of our tropical fruits, I think. We're also seeing new, you know, vegan and vegetarian restaurants are seizing this. There's a lot more categories. And I think the chefs are being challenged now to come up with inventive menus because, honestly, I think there's 200, maybe about 240 restaurants this year.
Mm-hmm.
So they're competing with other restaurants to offer something really special.
Do you think that over time, is it, and I wonder now, I mean, after 17 years, so if it's stuck around this long, it's successful, but that restaurants want to be a part of this. They look forward to this?
I think more and more so that we do. And I think that those of us that are in the business, we go out to the other restaurants too and see what else is going on. So on a Monday or a Tuesday when I might not be at the restaurant, we're closed on Mondays at 3, I'm going to go check things out too. And price is not necessarily my main motivator. It's really seeing what's going on that the other great chefs in town are doing.
All right, so I mentioned at the beginning also this idea of the Snail of Approval, Slow Food Miami. For the first time this year, Miami Spice has teamed up with Slow Food Miami to give restaurants this thing, this Snail of Approval. Let's get an understanding of what exactly is this slow food thing, what's going on. I want to hear from both of you on this, Gretchen. Let me start with you.
Well, Slow Food is an international organization that was born in Italy, and it really celebrates local products, whatever is local there. And the Miami chapter has, you know, been very active in having restaurants prove that they really are using local ingredients in their cooking, and if then they are so designated. So a diner there knows that, okay, this is a restaurant where I can experience stuff that, you know, comes from our own backyard.
As a consumer, how can I prove that? If you tell me that this is, our menu is mostly locally grown, how do I know that?
Well, that's where we come in because we spend a lot of time and effort trying to tell people what's local here. And certainly we live in a real transient area. So people from Michigan or Illinois or something like that, it's news to them that apples really don't grow here.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, restaurants now, look, certainly they can and have been caught cheating. But we don't see that. What we seek to do is educate people. So if you see a restaurant that would say, like, local heirloom tomatoes right now on their menu, they're not local. Unless there's perhaps Everglades tomatoes, but they're too small to really put on a menu dish, I think. Mm-hmm. So they need to understand what we grow here, and we teach that, and ask. Going to the farmers markets every week, and some of the farmers markets in particular, you have one very close here at the Arch Center on Monday nights, Southwest Market, and many of the other local markets there, they will say with little signs on their produce where it came from and whether it was local, what farm it came from, or if it came farther beyond, because this time of year there's pretty slim pickings for a lot of things. So they have to go to North Florida or sometimes the Carolinas, but they will label it.
Mm-hmm. Where's the pressure coming from on this local food scene? What is it, the consumer? Is it just the business, the way it is right now? Where's that pressure coming from? This is what we want now.
I think consumers are much more concerned as far as the where the food is coming from, how it affects them, not only from a flavor standpoint, of course, but from a health standpoint. I think there's a need for the truth and a desire for the truth. Laura Riley, the writer from Tampa, who wrote the amazing article Farm to Fable, really lit up a firestorm with that piece, and it went viral, and it was a good thing because she really caught a lot of people red-handed, and restaurants really can't afford publicity like that And if they're doing something like that, well, more power to the press. I believe in the press.
Well, thank you. I do as well. That's why I'm in it. But you know what? How hard is it to be a restaurant and to have a lot of your menu be locally grown? Especially, I mean, this time of year, as you said, Gretchen, I mean, this time of year, you should know because you know what's in season and what's not. You should.
Mm-hmm. If you have the kind of restaurant where the menu's laminated and printed like once a year, you've got problems. But at Three, the name of our restaurant, we, like others in the community, we print the menu every single day. And so, you know, we're talking to Paradise Farms or Harpke Farms, and we're saying, hey, you know, what's coming in? And they literally are bringing it in, and we're literally driving the girl in the office a little crazy because it's 4 o'clock and she's having to redo the menu.
You know what? Thank you for telling me that. I'm going to remember. I'll never forget that. I'm talking with Chef Norman Van Aken, host of A Word on Food, which airs on Saturday mornings here on WLRN. He's also the owner of numerous restaurants across South Florida. Also with me is Gretchen Schmidt, the editor of Edible South Florida. We're talking about Miami Spice. It's now in its 17th year and has teamed up with Slow Food Miami to highlight the restaurants that are sourcing locally grown, sustainable ingredients. I want to stay on the topic, though, for a second, because we were talking about the snail of approval. And there are a number of factors that go into whether or not a restaurant can qualify for the snail of approval. And we have a list from Slow Food Miami. And some of the things included: each snail of approval honoree must feature a minimum of 20% of their menu of local ingredients, whether that is by way of locally sourced proteins or produce. And it is not absolutely necessary, but it is widely encouraged that the snail of approval honoree also demonstrate at least two other forms of sustainability, such as featuring a seasonal menu, feature organic products, compost, recycle, etc. I saw the list. It's a long list, Gretchen. There was a point I was thinking, really, how many people can actually, you know, meet everything on that list?
Well, resourceful restaurant folks, I've seen this. We're just coming off of our mango season, for example, and it's a wonderful season. I've seen resourceful chefs put up chutney, okay? Or they and year long you will have chutney on the menu. You know, they will pickle things. Many local restaurants have walls of pickles, and they've put up all that produce. So there's a lot of ways to accomplish that local, aside from the obvious, you know, this lettuce was locally picked this morning. Seafood is another example. Consider our local seafood, and that's in our summer issue. We talk about that because, as you know, Norman, you know, especially down in the Keys, mm-hmm. A movement down there by a group looking to work with local commercial fishermen to supply local Key West shrimp and, of course, Florida lobster and local fish. They needed to do that in Key West because a lot of the seafood on the menu in Key West was coming in from other places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Norman, what would I need to ask? How would I know where my food is coming from?
Well, unfortunately, you sometimes cannot ask the staff in the restaurant because they simply aren't trained and don't know. I was in a restaurant in Key West a couple of summers ago, and the bartender highly recommended the local scallops to some folks that were down there on their honeymoon, and I said to her after they went back to their table, I said, what are you talking about, local scallops? I mean, what's local about them? She goes, well, they come from the freezer right out back.
That's their idea. Okay, so who am I supposed to ask? Do I go, hey, bring the chef out here? I want to, like, I know he's going to have time. Like, he wouldn't even talk to me. Is it the manager, the owner? Who am I talking to? Who am I asking?
Ask Edible Florida. Edible South Florida will tell you.
We ask, you know, and we insist that people ask, and we're seeing more people, as they know what they're talking about, asking and challenging those restaurants. And believe me, it only takes once or twice, and it only takes a couple of negative reviews to suddenly make the restaurant say, hey, wait a second, they're calling us out on this.
It's another form of the dirt on dining.
There you go.
Real quickly, Gretchen, talking about seafood, Edible South Florida's newest issue is all about seafood.
Yep.
Well, give us a little bit of a highlight.
Well, again, we were looking for places, markets that were selling local seafood. So we checked that out. We were looking at restaurants that had local shrimp on the menu or local dishes on the menu. Certainly, you're not going to get Alaska. You may have Alaska king crab on the menu, but we were looking for those who, you know, had some dishes that were local. And that's all in this issue.
And Norman, this is going to be the first year for your restaurant in Wynwood to take part in Miami Spice, right?
Right. Well, we're only not a year old yet.
Not even. What are you expecting? What do you think is going to come up for this year?
I'm looking forward to seeing more people learn about that we're there. You know, people associate Norman Van Aken with Coral Gables for many, many, many years, and they don't necessarily associate Wynwood with, except for a few great neighbors of ours like Alter and Q, they don't look at it like they do the Coral Gables area. So this could be a real torch for us, for people to find out that I'm cooking in Wynwood.
Check out his place. He is Chef Norman Van Aken, host of Word on Food, which airs Saturday mornings here on WLRN. And again, owner of numerous restaurants in South Florida, the one in Wynwood. So check it out. Also, Gretchen Schmidt, editor of Edible South Florida. Folks, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And enjoy your dining. Enjoy Miami Spice for the rest of the month. That's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. Talk to you tomorrow.